The following program is not for children. If you have a child with you, please know that the next hour contains descriptions of violence that adults will find unbelievable. We strongly recommend that only adults and mature adolescents listen to this program. This is John Greenman. It may seem unbelievable to us in our comfortable homes, but at any given time, there are children, 300,000 or more, engaged as child soldiers throughout the world, with a majority in Africa. Children are trained under the most brutal and inhumane conditions to become killers, rapists, torturers, and to perform mayhem. They're used by their adult abductors to create a climate of fear and terror among civilian populations. On September 20th of this year, Arthur Sirota, the executive director of the United Movement to End Child Soldiering, spoke to a group at the University of Maine, his alma mater. Sirota said he became interested in civil and social rights while he was a student in Orono. But it wasn't until 1980, as a Vietnam veteran and after a career as a civil rights lawyer in the States, that he finally discovered the hidden world of child soldiering in Africa. It changed his life.
And so in 1980, I took a sabbatical from law practice after 10 years, a very supportive law firm that I'd helped to found, and wound up in Zimbabwe, where I thought I would stay a month. And my second day, I met a chief, Chief Tangwena, of the Tangwena region, and who asked me, learning I was a lawyer who had a year on my hands and I'm in Zimbabwe, if I would be interested in coming back to his rural area and helping to build a high school. And I'd said, of course, as many of us might say in that circumstance, but sir, I've never built a high school before. And he said, you can do this. And so the next day I went with him and his senior wife and someone who lent us a car to this very beautiful remote area of Zimbabwe. It's still beautiful and remote, on the border of Mozambique, which is a very relevant point. And there I stayed for a year, helped to raise the funds for and mobilizing builders. And the bottom line is, in a year, myself and six others from the region, I was the only American in an area where people were now coming back from refugee status in Mozambique, including 900 children and youth to this one area called Niafaro. And we built a high school, raising funds. The children themselves were carrying the stones from the river and the sand, making bricks, local builders, architects. And we built, in a year, children, their parents, teachers, community members, a 17-building high school, classroom blocks, teachers' houses, dormitories, creche, library. And we the seven teachers with 900 students were teaching under trees as the high school was being built, and then as buildings were being built, we would teach inside. That high school is 26 years old now. I go back almost every year. Some of my former students are teaching there. This is a beautiful region, and I mention it because I'm going to now segue in a few moments into child soldiering. But this region, the Tangwena people, trace their roots back 500 years to the 1400s. They live indigenously. They live under indigenous leadership. They farm indigenously, terrace farming, as well as other kinds of farming, and they have appropriate technology. So after years of war, the liberation struggle, when this was a war zone, now people had come back in 1980, and now the region itself and Zimbabwe itself is developing. The massive building of schools and clinics, boreholes, roads, rural development, and it was quite a euphoric time in Zimbabwe at that time. It was a different Zimbabwe. And I went back ultimately in 1986. I left law practice to start other educational endeavors, which really had a lot to do with the fact that I'd gone back to Zimbabwe for 2 years after helping to build the school, and I taught in this Niafaro Secondary School for 2 years, English literature, and learned a lot about the relationship between teachers who come from the community and students who are also from that same community. Well, to move into child soldiering, I went back to visit in the Tangwena region in 1990 for a month. And at that time, an army called RENAMO. How many people can raise their hands and say that you've heard of RENAMO? I'll raise mine. Wow. Five. It's the highest number and percentage I've seen anywhere in a very long time. RENAMO, for those of you who didn't raise your hands, totally understandable. It's an army, proxy army, and in some ways a rebel army, and in some ways a combination of those that had been started by South Africa and then in the 70s to fight ZANU-PF, which was based in Mozambique, but really, again, reinstituted by South Africa as a means of punishing Mozambique because of its support of the liberation, the black liberation struggle of South Africa. Mozambique, under Samora Machel, the president, who ultimately would go down in a plane in 1986 with half his cabinet over South Africa, was allowing the ANC, the African National Congress, to have its bases and support in Mozambique as a frontline state supporting the liberation struggle inside South Africa. And the ANC and Nelson Mandela were considered to be rabid communists. Arguably today, Nelson Mandela is one of the most beloved figures in the world. And he was not a communist. But the U.S., or elements in the U.S., were supporting RENAMO under the anti-communist banner. The U.S. itself, the Congress, was supporting UNITA, another proxy and rebel army in Angola that was destabilizing Angola. Between 1986 and 1991, RENAMO killed more than 1 million people, almost all civilians, in Mozambique. Hacking off heads, dismembering people, mothers being raped in front of their daughters, daughters being raped in front of their mothers, hunting down teachers, nurses, doctors, and killing them in front of people's eyes, burning villages, burning clinics and schools to destroy the infrastructure, and about 4 million people who didn't die were raped and mutilated. Women's lips were being cut off. Women's noses and eyelids were being cut off. Breasts were being slashed. In fact, women in Mozambique eventually started to refer to themselves as women in a nation without lips. And about a third of the RENAMO soldiers were abducted children, child soldiers. Now, I had known about child soldiering in the 80s, and when RENAMO was on the border, but on the other side of the border, the Mozambique, and starting all of this killing, but it was still abstract for me. When I went back to visit in 1990, RENAMO was now attacking over the border onto the Zimbabwe side, and they had been doing so for some time, but I hadn't realized they were actually in my beloved Tangwena region. When I came back, my colleagues, my friends, former teachers, former students were saying, "You can't stay. You're going to get killed. You have to leave." That's when I decided I needed to stay. I needed to experience the same kind of fear that people who are being subjected to war, civilian populations being terrorized by war, feel every day, whether they get killed or not, whether they get mutilated or not, whether they witness atrocities or not. And I stayed for some time. And in the morning, I stayed in the same thatched hut that I used to live in when I was teaching there and working there. In the morning, I would go with others to the sites of where atrocities had taken place the night before or several nights before. And one of those occasions was visiting a village of a family I knew well, one of whose family members had been one of my students. And in visiting this village, about a 10-kilometer walk from where I was staying, which was closer to the border, RENAMO soldiers had swept in the night before, kicked down the door of the kitchen in this village. Three children were sleeping around the fire, which is common, and in particular in this situation where RENAMO, more people were staying more closely together. The RENAMO soldiers took a bayonet and plunged it into the chest of a 9-year-old girl who was a primary school student up the road. Using a knife, slit the throat of a two-year-old child from ear to ear and took a six-month-old baby and chopped it up into a pulp. And when I came by the next day, they had just scraped up the pulp, placed it in a white cloth to be buried. The mother of these children, hearing the screaming of her children, came running to rescue them, and LRA soldiers, including child soldiers, swiped her head off, or the top of her head, her scalp, with an axe. And then a neighbor who had been with her was also killed with an axe. These were the kinds of things that were going on. So at night, when I would be sleeping in my hut, hearing a twig breaking outside, the wind whipping through the trees, I had to wonder, was this the time that I would now be hearing the door crashing down and a bayonet plunging into my chest? This had an effect of reinforcing my commitment to helping to build peace, but especially to addressing the issue of child soldiering, which not only was still abstract to me, although living on the ground in Africa for quite some time, but still feeling, well, it happens to other people. It wouldn't necessarily be something that could happen to me or people I know feel close to. It was at that time that I resolved that one day I might become part of a movement or an organization that would address the issues of building peace on the ground, building a culture of peace at grassroots communities, and especially addressing the needs of children and youth impacted by armed conflict and war. So it was 11 years later in 2001 when I was now living in South Africa and working in a community in Soweto that a number of us who had attended a conference against racism sponsored by the UN in Durban in September 2001, that would be 16 years ago, that we came back from this very inspiring conference but still felt what goes on the ground was still not being addressed in a way that people could plug into it. And we felt, especially at that time, with wars raging in East Africa and Great Lakes, and then the war was still raging in Angola, millions of people being killed, 99% of whom are civilians, women and children being forced to do so much of the killing, that there needed to be a means by which grassroots communities most affected by war were actually leading the way toward building a culture of peace, preventing wars, and above all, addressing the needs of their children in their communities who were affected by conflict, the educational needs, the psychosocial needs, the community needs, and related needs. And so conceptually, in September 2001, after 3 days of brainstorming and analyzing, sitting on the floors of township shacks in Cliptown, Soweto, we came up with the idea that we should form a movement which we named the United Movement to End Child Soldiering, and that we would focus on Great Lakes, East Africa region, and Southern Africa as our beginning point, although with a global mission. But it took 3 years for us to really get off the ground. We were doing other things, and we decided that we would start an organization in the U.S., a nonprofit organization that would be a support arm as well as a lead organization that would forge its way onto the ground and start to make a difference in communities affected by conflict. And the bottom line was in April of 2004, I was appointed the executive director of United Movement to End Child Soldiering, and we chose Uganda as the place where we would have our beginning. Why Uganda? Because in 2004, Uganda had been involved in 18 years of war. Now it's 21 years, although there's been relative peace for the last year, which is called the war in northern Uganda. And just like many of us know about the war in Darfur because it's so publicized, almost no one knew outside of Uganda about the war in northern Uganda because it didn't have that profile. And we felt that this was where we would start our work because in this war between the government of Uganda and the Lord's Resistance Army, 85% of the army, of the Lord's Resistance Army, were children, mostly abducted children. And we felt this is where we needed to go, and this is where we felt we needed to explore and start our work, and that's what we did. I went to Uganda in 2004, spent considerable time, this is before we had a staff, spending considerable time exploring, listening, analyzing, and getting a sense of where we could make a difference rather than replicate or duplicate or do things such as an American organization coming in. And we also decided we needed to be a Ugandan organization. Ultimately, as we developed a staff, they're all from Uganda and northern Uganda, one from Zimbabwe. Now, at some point, I felt I wanted to talk to children and youth who had been abducted and had been child soldiers to get their perspective. What is most needed? Where do we make a difference? And that led to my meeting this person who I will now, if I can just move this, okay. And the person you're seeing, if you can see this a little bit on this image, on this laptop, is a person whose name I will not give you, but we'll call him Jeremiah. And he was then 17. And I'm interviewing him, and as you can see in this picture, which is just almost 3 years ago to the day, he's telling me his story of being abducted and his life as a child soldier. And this is in the context of a northern Uganda, which is mostly Acholi people, pastoralist, agricultural, land-rich culture, land-rich people, who before this war in northern Uganda were very, very prosperous for all the reasons I mentioned, cattle-rich, land-rich, communal culture, and a very disciplined culture, a lot of parental supervision, children and youth growing up with extended families, storytelling by the bonfire every evening in the village by elders with children and youth who learn those stories, learning culture, learning tradition, learning rituals. By the time Jeremiah was 12 years old, the war in Uganda was growing and developing. And this was a war between the Lord's Resistance Army, a rebel group. Time precludes going into the origins of this war. Many of you may know it. It's easily studied. But the bottom line is that there had been successive wars in Uganda since independence. There had been a lot of divide and rule by the British, colonial divide and rule, ethnically, sub-regionally, and otherwise, which is a very traditional way that the British and other colonial powers ruled their colonies. And it left Uganda in 1962 in a situation where there was continued wars. And when many people think of Uganda, you think of one man. What is that name? Idi Amin, exactly. And that was a real person. And in fact, in the 1970s, the reign of Idi Amin resulted in the massacre of hundreds of thousands of people. There's different figures on that. But in fact, a lot of people in the north had also been massacred by Idi Amin. So they had been through war before. And they had been victimized by war before. The way the British colonized also put a lot of people from the north, the Acholi people, into the army. And just like in many other colonial situations, other groups were civil servants, the Acholi were soldiers, creating a lot of grievances between people because people were used against each other. That's some of the background. But in any event, after the Idi Amin regime, he was ousted by a combination of this current government and the Acholi people and the government of Tanzania. But that also led to further elections which were disputed and military actions, which leads us to 1986, without going into the details, time precluding that, in which a rebel force in the north of Uganda called the Lord's Resistance Army claimed it was going to overthrow the government of Uganda for fear that the government was going to attack the north. So if I can just leave it in that context for the moment, the people of Acholiland did not endorse the Lord's Resistance Army. But the government and people generally outside the region assumed that the Lord's Resistance Army was something that was supported by the Acholi people. And so it led through a combination of misunderstanding, through a combination of unresolved grievances from the past, a combination of actions which triggered various reactions and provocations. It led ultimately to a war between the Lord's Resistance Army, a rebel group, and the government of Uganda's army. But who were victimized most by that war were the people of Acholiland, the people themselves. So the Lord's Resistance Army, not having any real support from the people, and the government of Uganda now arming the people with bow and arrows to defend against the Lord's Resistance Army, the Lord's Resistance Army started victimizing the Acholi community. And one of the ways they were victimizing them were punishing them for supporting the government, A, by attacking them, and B, because they didn't have the charismatic leadership to raise an army, because their cause was such that no one wanted to join them. They started abducting children, some as young as 8 and 10 years old, but average age 12. So that it was starting slowly, the abductions. People would hear about it, but it didn't necessarily scare them off their lands at first. Eventually, the government started developing internally displaced persons or refugee IDP camps, and people started leaving their traditional villages, their economies, their homes, and the families to go in these protected IDP camps. However, when Jeremiah was still 12, his family, among many families, had still not left. So here he is, 12 years old. Jeremiah had grown up in a very traditional family. He was doing very well in school. Doing well in school is encouraged. He was in grade 5. And on a particular afternoon in 1999, he came home at 2:30 in the afternoon. He had homework. He had chores to do. And a military unit of the Lord's Resistance Army swept into his family village. They were raiding his village. And the aim, to abduct children. And they grabbed Jeremiah, dragged him to his parents' hut, raised by his mother and father, started screaming at them. They started crying and screaming and wailing. They knew exactly what was going to happen. This was the scenario that had been happening, and finally it hit their home. And they screamed at his parents, "You, parents, you decide. We kill you, the parents, or we kill your son. Make a decision." And of course they did, as so many Acholi people and others who have been subjected to this kind of terror, whether in DRC, whether in other parts of the world, whether in Uganda, started pleading, "Kill us, you must kill us, save our son, don't kill our son." So there were child soldiers, and these were older commanders. They took a machete, which is called a panga in northern Uganda, pressed it into Jeremiah and said, "Kill your parents now." Jeremiah was traumatized, screaming, crying, he refused. They said, "All right." They ordered someone to bring in another small boy. They brought that person into the room. The commander took the panga and said, "If you don't kill your parents right now, we're going to kill all three of you in the same way we're going to kill this small boy." And without any notice or warning, they chopped off the head of this small boy and chopped him up into pieces. This was Jeremiah's cousin. Now his parents were really pleading, "Kill us, son. You have to kill us. If you don't, they'll kill us all." They took the machete. They handed it back to Jeremiah. He chopped off his mother's head, the mother that had raised him, that he loved, and just was wailing away, crying, screaming, panic-stricken, as his father sobbed and looked on, still standing. And then he chopped off his father's head and wailed away. Jeremiah was taken from the house outside, where other boys were also having been subjected to their ordeals, and then they were force-marched, as is the case, to southern Sudan, where then the Lord's Resistance Army was based. It was being supported by the Khartoum government at that time for a whole range of geopolitical reasons that can be studied. If there was more time, we would discuss. We have time for questions. We might go into that. In any event, and along the way, there were killings of others. And this is in a kill or be killed scenario. How many people are familiar with the book A Long Way Gone by Ishmael Bayer? It's a really important book to read. Ishmael is also a former child soldier in Sierra Leone, abducted when he was 13, his village and parents killed when he was 12. He became a child soldier. This is on the bestseller list. He's a graduate of Oberlin College now. And as Ishmael says, no child is born violent. He wasn't born violent. No child is born violent. And a long way gone means that he was a long way gone from his what? Anybody? He was a long way gone from his his traditional life, from his culture, his community. He wasn't born to kill. He didn't grow up to kill. He wasn't conditioned to kill. He was conditioned to be respectful, to love family, to love community, to be nonviolent, in fact. But by the experiences he went through, not unlike the experience of Jeremiah, whom I'm describing to you, he decided in order to live, he, like other children in this situation, when you understand that it's kill or be killed, you have to decide you survive or you don't. And not all children survive this. Those that do have figured out that you have to submit to whatever you're told to do, and you have to even pretend and even possibly get into what you are doing. Because if it's believed or suspected by your commanders who've captured you or forcibly forced you into the situation, you are killed or tortured. When Jeremiah and others reached their base camp in the LRA base camp in southern Sudan, they were then taught how to kill, attacking Dinka farmers, who were also pastoralist people, killing them and their families, stealing their cattle to eat. Rebel forces generally don't have a payroll. It's another reason why children are the soldier of choice in many armies around the world today. He went through that for 6 months and then was sent back to northern Uganda with units and with others, and for the next 2 years, until he was 14 and a half, conducted a number of atrocities in villages and in other scenarios, similar to that which he had experienced. And then when he was 14, as with the case of many children who are forced into soldiering, a certain amount of trust is built up, and you start to realize that you possibly can escape, and you feel more freedom to escape. And he found his moment of escape and did, in fact, escape. At age 14, he was rescued by the Uganda Army and brought to an internally displaced persons camp, IDP camp, in fact, the subject of this picture. And there as an orphan, went to that camp after a month of being in a reception center, a little bit of counseling, not much, and was taken in by a surrogate family. That's one of the gifts of Africa. Kinship, family. Africa is still alive and well in terms of kinship and children growing up with extended family, and in cases such as in war, with surrogate family. This is a child, I run a family. This child's not related to me, but he or she has no parents or no family. I take him or her in. That's now my child. That's surrogate family. It's kinship. It is one of the underlying gifts of African culture and the underlying strengths of African culture. He was taken in by a surrogate family, and then for the next 3 years he went back to primary school in the IDP camp, but still as an orphan and still not really having a bright future, except that he was very smart and very avid reader-oriented and very learning-oriented, as are almost all children and youth in rural Africa. His uncle, by the way, that I mentioned earlier, was killed in a raid in December of 2006, an LRA raid. So Jeremiah was among those who were brought to me to hear his story, and I heard his story, and I've just shared that part of his story with you. As I continue with his story, after him telling me this story, now he's in grade 7, and in Uganda, grade 7 is your last year of primary school. Now, if you have the school fees and you qualify by tests and school recommendations, you're eligible as a candidate to go on to secondary school. But in war zones where people have been displaced and therefore no longer producing income, those school fees are not available. So very few secondary school age students in northern Uganda have been in school compared to the large number. We walked around the camp, and I basically said to Jeremiah, what's next? What is it you need, without implying that our organization could help or would help? And what do you think he said? What was the number one thing on his mind? You started to raise your hand. You only touched your chin. So I was still ask you what you think. What was the number one goal he had at that time? Education, exactly. And yes, if anyone said building a peaceful culture or having another family, the kind of family life he had before, but education, he saw as all the children and youth who come back who've been abducted or otherwise affected by war, that education is number one. And he went so far as to say that not only will I have to join the army because I have no other choice, meaning the Ugandan army, because that's where at least I'll have food, I'll have a uniform, I'll have some status, I'll have some income, I'll have some future. He said, if I'm educated, I can go anywhere. I can go far. I can come back and help my community. I can be a major, major strength without education. So I said, and he went so far as to say that if your organization does all these great things, if you help to build peace, if you do this, you do that, it'll mean nothing to us as youth without education. That's number one. So that eventually, some months later, I came back. I came back to this particular camp with a member of my board of directors, as you can see in this picture. We had made a decision, and as a result of that, we started a program in early February of 2005, now known as the Northern Uganda Education Program, now in year three of our organization, UMEX, where we started to sponsor holistically children and youth affected by conflict. Not all child soldiers, but children abducted, child mothers, former child soldiers, and others, including those who'd witnessed atrocities. And now we have 83 students in 14 partnered schools in northern Uganda and northeast Uganda, where we also extended our program. And we provide holistic education in that we do the school fees and we do uniforms and school requirements of every nature, the mattresses, the book bags, the trunks, the transport, leaving a small part for the surrogate family or the guardian or the family to also do, small as it may be, so that there's a relationship with the family and not always looking to the sponsor. I should also mention that all of our staff, our education staff, are from northern Uganda. They walked in the shoes of our students. They come from the same communities. They're personally affected, some of them whose parents were killed by the Lord's Resistance Army, so that they all made it to university, became educators, social workers, and others, so they're also excellent mentors as well as administrators of this program. Now, the good news. This is Jeremiah today. If you're sitting back there, you may not be able to see this very well. In the yellow shirt, we enrolled Jeremiah at Rachkoko Vocational Secondary School. All of our other students are in more academic streams. This is also an academic institution, because Jeremiah said he wanted to be an architect. And in this particular school, it prepares architecture and building and design. We enrolled him with seven other students. But the reason we chose this school is that in reviewing his math and science materials the next day after my first interview with him, he was getting 100% in math, 100% in this, 100% in that. I was tremendously jealous, never having been very good at math. But in Uganda, as in many African education systems, the level of math is actually higher than here by grades. It was obvious that he was a very serious student. When I commented on that, I said, you're a math genius. He said, no, not really. He said, many of us are so great in math. Many of us are good readers. Many of us are into science. He said, this is us. This is the way we are. Well, I knew that from having taught in Zimbabwe. And Jeremiah, if you can see this, this is another picture of Jeremiah. He's looking at a newsletter. This is a few months ago, looking at a newsletter put out by our partner, Africa University in Zimbabwe, in which he's pictured, because we have graduate students from Africa University who come every year, who are teachers, pastors, social workers, peace-building practitioners, mostly in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, who come to northern Uganda under our auspices, who work with our programs, our students, and also partnered agencies. So they're culturally connected, they're community connected, but they're also peace-building practitioners. Now, this genuine smile, the fact that Jeremiah is number 7 in his class at Rochecoco, the fact that he became a community volunteer, the fact that he's a school leader, how does someone go from the scenario I described to be all of the atrocities that committed on him, that he committed on others, being an orphan, the loss of parents, the displacement to a squalid IDP camp, then being 3 years in school and being really squared away. Resilience in the Acholi society is actually the main story. But nevertheless, how does that kind of trauma get healed? How do communities forgive? How does he forgive himself? The answer is that the Acholi culture has had an indigenous worldview for hundreds and hundreds of years, some say going back more than 1,000 years, of reconciliation, of traditional justice, of restorative justice. It's not really an unusual concept. The Western worldview, although predominant today, nevertheless, is the newcomer. For thousands of years, and today still in many, many cultures, there's a separation between the wrong and the wrongdoer, the actor and the act. And restorative and particularly traditional justice and reconciliation-oriented societies believe that punishment of a wrongdoer does not solve the problem, but getting to the root cause, how it happened, why it happened, what are those circumstances? And the healing of someone who has been through what Jeremiah has been through and those with whom he was forced to interact with and commit atrocities upon were into. It's not just his own healing, but his healing took place with others. The difference in many ways between the rehabilitation of those who are affected by war, say, here, and those affected by war in many African societies, is that here we try to heal the person or rehabilitate the person. And there, in Acholi land and in many African societies, it is the community as well as the person that is being rehabilitated and healed together. That's why for so many of us who have the experience of knowing so many Vietnam vets, for instance, one of the things that I did in law practice for many years was represent many Vietnam vets suffering from the violence they'd been through, seen, perpetrated. Many committed suicide. Many wound up in prison. They didn't come home to a loving, receptive society. They weren't forgiven. They couldn't forgive themselves, suffering internally. Whereas in indigenous African societies, when people have been involved in these circumstances, perpetrator or victim, or the case of child soldiers, both, the entire history of the culture and of the healing process is the healing of the community together with the person. So in Jeremiah's case, the process, which is called Matu Aput, was Jeremiah telling his story in every detail, the pain he suffered, how he felt, what he went through, how it affected him then, how it affects him now. And then others who were affected by what Jeremiah was forced to do also tell their stories, what they went through, what they suffered, what they lost, how it affected them, how it affects them now. This is all facilitated by elders. It used to be traditional leaders, and now it's elders, including traditional leaders, because people are in the camps. And logistically, it's hard to find everyone together and put them into the ceremonies. But in fact, it's the ritual and the ceremony. It also includes all of the sides at the end of their storytelling, drinking from the common calabash or cup of a bitter potion, which everyone drinks to get rid of the poison and then to move forward. And that, in fact, is the essence of peace building. It's not the only way to peace build, but in indigenous worldview, it includes the cleansing and the rehabilitation of the community itself, of the victim and the perpetrator together, with the idea of Ubuntu. Ubuntu is behind this, including other. What is Ubuntu? U-B-U-N-T-U. You ever heard the term Ubuntu? It's a very common concept in indigenous cultures. But it means, that's the Zulu word for the interpretation indigenously, which one of the meanings is, in Zulu, I am because you are. Ubuntu. I am because you are. But in order to have these cultural healings and rehabilitation of community, victim, and offender together, you have to have what? You have to have community in the first place. You have to have that source of community, which may be a combination of family and friends and colleagues. It also means people have a common heritage, culture, historical memory, etc. Many forms of community. People that are older in America can say, I can remember when we had much more of a sense of community in my town, in my realm. I'll say that a school becomes a community, and now that's part of Jeremiah's community. And in fact, that's one of the advantages of children who've been affected by a conflict of being in school, that you now are in a protected environment, and the teachers also become your surrogate parents. They are mentors. The school leadership you look up to almost like a chief. And because, although English is the national language, people are still also learning in their home language. So a combination of your classmates, your teachers, your faculty, and then your other family during school breaks is a very important community, which is why students, former child soldiers and child mothers and others deeply affected by conflict, when they're back in school, are now back for the first time in a normal environment, especially in the context of a war zone where a war's still going on. I should tell you some good news, and that is for the last year in northern Uganda, 14 months has been relative peace. And we must give praise and support to the government of Uganda and likewise the fact that the Lord's Resistance Army has been willing to come in and the former president of Mozambique, Chizano, and the vice president of Southern Sudan are actually mediating this. And the two armies that have been fighting each other for years with a Acholi community involvement have been for the last year mediating their own, it's called the Juba Peace Talks, the end of this war, and this ceasefire has held for 14 months. So there's relative peace in northern Uganda. There's also a lot of flooding in northern Uganda right now. That's a whole other story. Now, I've only given you the example of Jeremiah. I'll just tell you a less than 1 minute story of one of our students. We'll call her, so I will not give you her name, but let's just call her Alice. And when Alice was about 10, she was abducted with other girls, and she was forced to do what is probably the worst thing anyone could be forced to do. She and other girls, when she was 10 and the other girls were various ages, were forced to kill a grandmother in a horrible way. That would be the most horrible thing one could think of anywhere, and I can tell you in a Acholi society, the way in which children grow up to respect elders and love elders, and especially the grandmothers. Now that would sound like the absolute worst, but the absolute worst after that was she and the other girls were forced to drink the blood of the grandmother. Now Alice is one of our students, or under our auspices in one of our partnered schools, which is called Alliance College Secondary School in Kitgum District. She's in senior two. She's doing exceedingly well in school. She's also a mother because of her ordeal. So she does well in school. She's a role model. She's also a school leader. And every night, she has nightmares. She's not gone through the healing process. But even if she has, it's the healing process on the one hand, and there's also psychosocial needs, the need for counseling, the need for that kind of support. So giving you these anecdotes through two of our students who really typify what so many children of youth have been through. The good news is their resilience when they're in school. The good news is their determination to move forward. The good news is their belief in reconciliation and wanting to improve themselves, their schools, their families, their societies. However, the needs are great. So in year three of our work on the ground, in addition to the programs we have, the core programming of which is peace and education, I think we have 5 minutes, is that right? So let me wrap up telling you about two programs we have so that we've developed strategies instead of just thinking about how do we support our 83 students in 14 schools? Well, we're doing that. Now, 83 is a big number for us because we're a small, young organization. But it's just the tip of the iceberg in northern Uganda with hundreds of thousands of children and youth with these needs, the majority of whom are not in secondary school. We decided that these needs are so great in all of the schools and communities, but we're working with schools at this point. So we decided to start school-based programs that address the psychosocial needs of children and youth as well as the peace-building needs of society. So I'll wrap up by telling you that earlier this year, in collaboration with our partner, Africa University, a team from Africa University, to the head of their counseling department and a team of graduate students, came to northern Uganda with us and, working with one of our schools, Lita Palor Senior Secondary School in Pader District, piloted stage one of a counseling and guidance program. Working with 29 teachers, we also brought in military commander and soldiers because they're also part of the community and community members. And we did research of the needs of the 700 students, 60% of whom have been formally abducted, and developed through a training of 29 teachers stage one of a counseling program. And now we'll build on that, sending the teachers out for formalized training, certificate level and diploma level training, so teachers can cope with and address the psychosocial counseling and guidance needs. Now, this is just a pilot. It's just the beginning. But our plan is to replicate the program and then hopefully mainstream the program. What's lighting up rooms in northern Uganda now is a program that we're in process of launching, and it's called School-Based Peace Education. School-Based Peace Education. And working with three partnered schools and two universities and our own staff, we are developing a school-based program that will have three components. One, curricula, peace studies. Two, youth-led peace activities, drama, community radio, expressive arts, debates, essays. And then three, community and family projects that take the learning into the community and into family so that what is learned is practiced and emanates out into the community and family. Starting in secondary school where we are, we'll then replicate it and expand it to primary school. And as we always say, and you won't be spared this analogy, just as Tiger Woods is arguably the greatest golfer in the world, and there's others, when did he start playing golf? He was just about this high. And we feel just as those who become great golfers and great mathematicians, readers, and others, they start early, and they become great, and they become practiced, and they become skilled. And we feel that it's long overdue, as the schools we're working with and our youth, that if we're going to build a culture of peace to prevent war, that you start with children when they're young and keep going, so that they become practiced, skilled practitioners of peace, not just believing in peace, not only just working at peace, but practitioners of peace. Because child soldiering, we believe, will never end, ever, until war ends, because in today's wars, children are the soldier of choice. And as we know from looking at Darfur, or if you think about the war in Vietnam, you think about the current war, you think about the war in Democratic Republic of Congo, once wars start, like forest fires, they rage out of control. So preventing war, like preventing AIDS, like preventing violence, needs to happen. And we also as a society would benefit by building a culture of peace, but I think we're less motivated to do so because we're less directly affected by war. We should be as a matter of conscience, but we're not being directly in the same way, in the same proportions, victimized by war. But in societies such as in northern Uganda, which are war-weary and with so many war-affected people, children, youth, and women, there is that desire, that calling to build a culture of peace. So I hope to come back sometime and share with you what the progress is of that. We're working also with the education department, local government, schools, and it's exciting to them as it's exciting to us. So I have a lot of hope for the future. I continue to have hope for the future, but what reinforces me the most are the strengths of African people and African society, kinship, Ubuntu, and peace. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Arthur Sirota, Executive Director of the United Movement to End Child Soldiering. Mr. Sirota spoke at the University of Maine on September 20th. For more information about the child soldiering problem and efforts to deal with it, log on to endchildsoldiering.org. That's endchildsoldiering.org. I'm John Greenland.